Welcome to the Edge of Work podcast. I'm your host, Al D. This is a podcast for leaders who want to make sense of workplace trends and are looking for new ideas about how to lead people and grow their business in a changing world of work. During each episode, I'll bring you the latest experts, researchers, founders, and leaders to share new and unique ideas, as well as actionable advice around attracting and retaining talent, developing people, and building healthy and sustainable organizations. Welcome to the Edge of Work podcast. My name is Al D, and I am the host of the Edge of Work podcast. Today's guest is Kim Lear. Kim is the founder of Inlay Insights, a consultancy and research firm that helps organizations through research prepare for a changing workforce and changing marketplace. I first heard Kim speak almost a decade ago when my organization actually brought her in for our own conferences and events to talk about generational trends in the workplace. And I was excited to bring her on the Edge of Work podcast to talk about some of those issues. Kim's been studying generations in the workplace for over 15 years and has a keen insight into some of the trends, but tends to also look at this from a sociological perspective, which I think gives a lot of additional richness to the context and understanding of not only what are some of these trends, but what's going on in the world that is influencing them when they're coming to light. So this was a really great conversation in particular about how to actually use generational insights in ways that are actually effective and that help leaders run better companies and make better decisions related to the talent that they have in the workplace. I hope you enjoy this conversation. I know that I did. And as always, please let me know what you think and what resonated. And here is my conversation with Kim. All right, we're back on the Edge of Work podcast. Today, I have the pleasure of having with me Kim Lear, who is the founder of Inlay Insights, as well as the author or editor of the newsletter Kids These Days. As listeners of this podcast know, I always love starting with a warm-up question. And so, Kim, my warm-up question to you is, what was your first job and what did you learn from that experience?
My first job was working at the jewelry counter at Marshall Fields in Minnetonka, Minnesota, in a mall. And Marshall Fields, it doesn't exist anymore, but it was a sort of fancy department store. And I was 16 years old and I loved that job. I think there's a lot to learn from working retail. And jewelry, I think it was interesting to be young and working in that space because jewelry is such a weirdly like personal thing for people. The older girls from high school would come in and they wanted jewelry for prom, and parents would come in and they wanted something special for their kids' sweet 16, and boys would come in and they wanted something for their girlfriends who they pissed off, whatever that was. And so I think you don't know what you're learning in the moment, but I think in retrospect, a lot of it was understanding how emotional purchasing behavior is, understanding how the huge impact that your colleagues have on your everyday experience at work. I think I learned a lot of small talk. I was paid on commission. So it's like you had to be like, where are you going on vacation? And what do you usually wear? So it was just that piece of connecting with people, of understanding their needs, of meeting their needs, and being really customer service oriented.
So many good lessons from a first job. And in the work that you do now as a researcher, as a speaker, as a writer, you observe a lot of things and witness a lot of things and research a lot of things about the world of work. And I think it's trite to say this at this point, but I still think it's true. World of work's changed quite a bit over the past few years. And I'd love to know from your perspective, maybe two sides of the coin here. What's something about the world of work that excites you right now? And on the flip side of that, what's something that perhaps concerns you?
I thought a lot about this because my answers for both are actually entangled in one another. I think something that concerns me, and this sort of started back in 2016, where I became a little bit worried about the way that partisanship and culture across the board was impacting the workplace. And there was this phenomenon that's been discussed quite a bit of these ideologically homogenous C-suites attracting an ideologically homogenous workforce that was catering to a pretty ideologically homogenous customer. And over time, I just began to wonder if this is really where we wanted to go as a country, if we wanted to be in a situation where it was like Democrats eat at one chicken sandwich shop and Republicans eat at another. And just I was faced with this question of, oh man, like how far away do we want to be from one another? And back in 2004, a book that just had a lasting impact on me was journalist Bill Bishop wrote The Big Sort. And that's where he dug into a lot of this demographic data that showed that over the past three decades, Americans have been sorting themselves into these really homogenous communities. And so we just don't have a lot of shared spaces anymore with people who are different from us. And work became like the last bastion of ideological diversity. And so it did really worry me. It did concern me where I'm like, if most of us do have this goal around civility, inclusivity, understanding, it's just imperative that we are around people who are different from us. And that's very connected to what I'm excited about, because I do think that more and more workplaces that I am working with, more leaders that I'm speaking with, are revisiting how they define and execute on inclusivity and belonging, and how there is this emergence of a real focus on how within the walls of an organization, people can feel really committed to pushing the same boulder over the same hill. And so I think in some ways, I'm excited about the potential for the workplace to serve as this really interesting and critical space where perhaps we can find a way back to each other in some ways.
I'm glad you found the glass half full viewpoint on that, because they could very much see, particularly given the context of the Big Sort and even where we are today, the challenges that come with that. And this isn't going to be a conversation about technology and the media, but when I think about the Big Sort and I think about technology platforms today, in many ways, that just amplifies what you just talked about in terms of siphoning off or cordoning off people into their own kind of little thought bubbles, if you will. And certainly the role that people also obviously play within that. But on the optimistic side of things, I think you are right in terms of, for most of us who are working, that is the one thing that unites us all. Nobody really goes to work each day wanting to do a bad job. Most of us want to go to somewhere each day where we can do a good one, where we can feel that we are pushing towards something that is bigger, that is allowing us to use our talents and skills. And I do want to go further to talk a little bit more in particular about how that relates to perhaps the generations that are in the workplace. And Zoe, before we get into that discussion, I know that you often look at generations through your field of study, which is sociology. So just for the listeners out there, could you talk about why that matters and how that helps shape your perspective and why that is so valuable?
I feel like I went through this phase during adolescence that a lot of people go to, where you go down this rabbit hole of Tocqueville and Weber and Durkheim, and you're just this like first grand exposure to this idea that society is a man-made construct, and that we have this very symbiotic relationship with culture and with society, where we are always impacting it and it is always impacting us. And so I think it's hard for me to not look at it through that lens, just because I think it's more interesting. But I also find that it's just valuable for many different reasons, right? It allows us to put our lived experiences within a broader context, and it prohibits us from doing this focus group of one type of thing. It allows us to view the data a little bit more objectively so that we can actually find deeper insights that maybe go past our own experiences. And Al, I think that this is something that you and I really come together on, is that this conversation of generations has become like so silly in a lot of ways, where it will be like, I'm a millennial, and so my experience is representative of all of these things. And it's, you can't, that isn't a way to capture the ethos of an era. And that's really what we're trying to pinpoint, is how these moods change and why they do. How did we get to where we are, and where might we go from here? Those are the fundamental questions. And people are really unreliable narrators. And so I know that there is a big focus in certain areas of research on the lived experience, but I think just listening to people, we lose half of the story. So like an example of this idea that like people don't, you don't know the own water that you're swimming in, right? A fish does not know it's in water, is that if you talk to young people today who grew up in a middle class or an upper middle class family, it's hard not to notice the competitive nature of their adolescence. But when they, and there's a lot of different things that they say to me where I can pinpoint this, but they would never say to me something like, growing up in an era of increased inequality where good jobs are getting better and bad jobs are getting worse and middle jobs are disappearing and the fear of becoming obsolete is at my heels and status seems harder to get and easier to lose, this is why I put pressure on myself. They would never say that, because they don't know that. But when you put this generational conversation in a more historical context, view it through a more sociological lens, we're able to get this better understanding of how these perceptions emerge. And then that gives us a better ability to think through more critically, now what? Now what do we do with that?
So speaking of now what, and so what do we do with that? Let's have the conversation about with generations in the workplace. A lot of people want to talk about the multi-generational workforce, about how there are four or five generations in the workforce at this time, and how that this is a unique time in our landscape. And I guess, from your perspective, why do you think it's important to talk about this or highlight or acknowledge about this? And why should a leader of an organization care about it?
We're always trying to build bridges. We're trying to leverage the strengths of everyone. And so having the leveraging the wisdom of experienced workers and the innovative naivete of young workers is critical. I think we're always trying to find ways to connect with one another. I think people inherently do want to understand, like, what is it like to be you? People are interested in this question of, if I were born into a different time, how would I see this differently? So I think that's one of the reasons why leaders care about it. I also think we cannot help ourselves. It is such a fascinating subject to, and we, these are the questions that are going through our own minds all the time. Parents ask themselves all the time, how come my kid's childhood is so different from mine? How come their view of success is different from mine? How come what motivated me doesn't seem to motivate them? And so I think that in a lot of ways, this study of generations gives us a really digestible framework to ask ourselves to answer these questions that we all have mulling in our minds.
And I think that's such a good point. And I don't know if this lands at all, but one of the things I often think about with this is that there is, let's just say someone says something at work, right? There is the thing that they say. There is the experience that maybe perhaps led them to say that thing, right? And then there is the underlying belief that they have, right? And depending on how far you deep you get into knowing that person or the empathy that you have, if you're not getting to all those three things, you may not truly understand why they acted in a certain way. When you get to that belief, that core belief of what it is, what ultimately oftentimes shapes that might be their upbringing, the culture that they were a part of when they often grew up. And to your point, if you really want to bring out the best in all the people, it does make sense and it behooves you to the degree that you can understand what might be one of many things that might be shaping that belief that impacts the experience, that impacts that like word or action, the better off you might be in getting to some understanding about it.
And I think that goes up and down. I think another reason why there is sometimes some animosity around this topic for some people is because it has traditionally been really youth focused, where it's very much, hey, for experienced people who have dedicated their entire lives to this organization or to this cause, this is how far you need to bend. This is the work that you need to do to better understand them. But it's very much both ways. When I do studies on young people who have faster career trajectories, more better relationships with mentors, they do this very inherently, where they ask themselves also about people more senior, how would I have thought about this differently if I came into work when you did? What are the sacrifices that you had to give in order to get to where you are? And how do I show some understanding for that? And so it goes person to person, regardless of their position, regardless of their generation.
I think that's such a great point. And I think for me, one of the things I often talk about with individuals and more so with leaders, but also for any individual, is this concept of learn and teach. And it's just this idea that everyone has an ability to learn, but it means also everyone has also the ability to teach others. And I think working in such a way with humility, to your point, I think also opens up the conversation and the dialogue to not just about, to borrow a phrase, kids these days, but to the openness of really making it a point to understand the lived experiences, regardless of the generation that you're in. I think one of the data points that often I've been fascinated by lately with respect to just more so age than generation, but just the fact that a lot of our workforce is getting older and is working longer. And it is really fascinating sometimes, to me at least, in thinking about how much that we spend on this generation that is entering the workforce, which is rightly due. But what are the implications about looking at folks who are towards the end of what we traditionally would have thought about in terms of work and career, and what opportunities might be there? But a lot of times that even gets missed because, to your point, we tend to be really incredibly focused on the ones who are most entering it.
Absolutely. Yes, that we could talk about that all day.
So I think we answered this one, but just I wanted to ask more about a healthy way to maybe view the generational topic as it relates to the workplace, and to maybe sidestep some of those criticisms. Anything else you might want to add just in terms of thinking about how do we approach the topic of generations in a workplace in a way that really is both more kind of research and fact-based, but also perhaps helpful and productive versus kind of the traditional us versus them mindset?
This idea of generational hazing is one that's always been around, which is really rooted in this idea that you cannot have what I have unless you go through exactly what I went through. And it's so human. That's the thing that I don't even say that to shame anyone, because I'll be in focus groups with, you know, with people in their 70s and hearing their stories of how they got to where they are. And it is a story of sacrifice. It is a story of all of the anniversary dinners that were missed, sometimes their health being sidelined, the missed dance recitals, the missed t-ball game. It is that path to success was paved with pretty monumental sacrifices. And so it's very human to say, well, I'm not, then you can't have this unless you sacrifice the same things. But it just gets in the way of progress for all of us. And the best leaders that I have ever known are the people who could get past that very human reaction and saying, what are the changes that I can make so that perhaps their path is allowed to look different from mine, but maybe their success looks the same.
I recently had a conversation with a leader of an organization who was dealing with a similar mindset. They, in this particular organization, they have a lot of new hires who are coming fresh out of college, and they have a lot of very senior leaders who have worked in this profession for a long time. And it very much was always an up or out kind of culture. And one of the things that this person said to me is that they often hear the kids these days, they have it so easy, or I had to do this and they should too. And this person told me that whenever someone says that, he always says back to them, yeah, but was that fun?
There's so many. That's such a good point. And if we look at baby boomers, and I will stand by this, that you hear it so much in these focus groups, again, that path to success paved with a lot of sacrifice. However, for their parents, right, for traditionalist parents, if you grew up in America, half of those men were veterans of World War II or the Korean War. And it was a kind of grueling existence in a lot of ways. And it wasn't that long ago where the majority of people worked outside on farms and then they worked in factories. And now people work, some work in offices, and one day we won't. And so even having that mental flexibility of recognizing that there is an ebb, the way we work, our relationship to work, it constantly changes. And the more that we hold on to what was with white knuckles, the less we're able to see the possibilities of something better for all of us.
I had a lot. So I want to transition a bit. So I know that you've been studying this topic of generations in the workplace for, I think, 15 plus years now. And I would just be curious to know for you, do you observe or see anything that's different about the workplace today versus when you first started and started doing this research?
Oh my gosh, yes, I do. A lot has changed in 15 years. I mean, I jotted down a few of the things that were top of mind, but I'm sure we could go on forever. I think one of the big shifts that I've noticed is just this, a shift in the role that corporations play or at times are expected to play in matters of morality. And again, we could go into a million different reasons about how this potentially happened and pros and cons, unintended consequences. But 15 years ago, corporations have always played some role, absolutely, in politics and policy, all of these things. But over the past 15 years, there's been a shift. This next thing, it almost sounds so cliche to say, but this hunger for really meaningful connections post-COVID is potent. In all, it's in the dating scene. I do work in like food and beverage. I'm looking at what's going on in the social spaces, what's going on in work. Young top talent basically refusing to work at remote only jobs. There was just a lot that has happened about how this craving of connection and how that manifests. And then tech. It was, if there was one thing to laugh at in 2020, which there were not a lot, but it is that Skype came out in 2005 and was basically mainstream by 2008. And the workplace needed a complete like breakdown of society in order to leverage the tech that already existed. And so the way that COVID really transformed the world of work, the leveraging of tech, the optimizing of processes, the shifting of expectations, I would say those are some big shifts.
Hey there, it's Al, and thanks for listening to the Edge of Work podcast. I wanted to take a quick break to ask you a small favor. I'm loving doing this show, and I hope you're enjoying it. And that's where I'd love your help. If you're enjoying this episode, I would really appreciate if you take a few minutes to leave a review and rate this podcast wherever you get your podcasts, or simply just share it on social media or with your friends. I'm incredibly grateful for your support. Thank you, and let's get back to the show. So, one big shift, I think, most recently since the pandemic has been the ushering and welcoming of Gen Zers in the workforce. And yes. I think that there is one school of thought or one narrative about how some Gen Zers are pushing back on some of the, or not even pushing back, are questioning or wondering about some long-held norms about some aspects of work, and for that matter, the workplace. And I would just love to know from your perspective, just based off of research that you've done or research that you've seen, what's the nuance in here? What of this is true or accurate, and versus what maybe is just, this is what happens when a new generation enters the workforce and looks around and just looks at it through their own experiences and says, huh, this looks interesting or this looks different.
It's always been there. And every generation, when they step into adulthood, they're given this moment where they can reevaluate the society that they inherit. And it's within that evaluation that change, sometimes progress, occurs. And so Gen Z is very much at that point. I think there are two ways in which I do see some real changes that can happen as Gen Z in larger numbers comes into the workforce. One of them, and I say this like almost in jest, and I don't at all mean this as a jab, but there is a very low tolerance for suboptimal use of time. And I think that permeates through other generations, but Gen Z, and I hear this from hiring managers and from young people. And I can share just one story from a study that we did, but we followed young people into their first in-person work experience, and they had to have done 1 year of university virtually and have participated in a virtual internship. So I'll just share the story of one young man, and his story exemplifies a lot of what we heard. But smart guy, very ambitious guy, he still wanted to perform at high levels at school and his internship during the pandemic. And so he really took that time to figure out how to optimize his own time, how to use his time more perfectly, more usefully, more effectively, how to leverage the right technology tools to make that possible, figured out the best time to exercise, the best time to eat, the best time to do creative work, the best time to answer emails, all of these things. He comes into the in-person work experience for the first time in the summer of 2021, and we follow up a couple weeks later to see how it's going. And he tells us a whole host of things, and at the end he says, and then I go to put money in the vending machine at work, and the wrong chips came out. And I was like, that's the last straw. And I remember listening to this story being like, what a weird hill to die on. But when I put it in this framework of he's young, he's porous, malleable, he, to no fault of his own, was put into this situation where in order to perform at high levels, he had to optimize his own time. He had to figure out how to use that more perfectly, more usefully, more effectively. It coincided with the emergence of a lot of tech tools that also enabled that. Coming into the in-person work experience, and everything felt suboptimal. And I do feel like Gen Z will usher in this idea of how do we use our time together in this more perfect, more useful, more effective way. And I think that could be a really good thing. The one other piece that I just have to say that I am finding interesting right now is like, there's this idea that hard times make strong people. And I think some could argue that we are in a hard time, that there are some like existential threats that do exist. And it's been interesting to watch some of the best talent funnel into these areas that we're seeing a lot of tech talent interested in hardware, in defense technology. We're looking at some of what's happening in El Segundo. We're looking at this rise of money flowing into that space from VCs. And somewhat of this shift towards this work that really fundamentally matters. And to give like a generational comparison, I think a lot of millennials will remember when the early Facebook employee, Jeffrey Hammerbacher, he famously declared that the best minds of my generation are thinking about how to make people click ads. And this is almost, there's mythology around this quote. And again, not that one generation is wrong and one is right, but it's a different time. And something that does make me really excited is I think there is some truth to this hard times make strong people mindset. And there is a at least critical part of Gen Z that is really leaning into that. And I think that will change the future of work as well.
I know that you do a ton of other research and studies. And so I just want to give you a chance now just to maybe talk about some of that. What are some things that either that you're studying or that you're paying attention to, either through your own research or just other research that you've seen, that maybe perhaps isn't necessarily seeing the light of day in the news or in the media, or that's being covered more broadly?
Some of it is being covered and some isn't. COVID's legacy is just something that, and I know there's just a lot of like fatigue and people are, it's over, let's just never talk about it again. But the impacts of school closures on Gen Z. I work with a lot of K through 12 schools. I work with a lot of superintendents looking at different states and different policies and some of the impacts, particularly on high school students at that time. Also, the way work was reshaped. I'm doing a lot of looking into the shifts in our perceptions of well-being. And just as people are living longer, this health span revolution, and how longevity planning really changes modern lifestyles. And Gen Z is particularly in tune with that. A real shift in the mental health conversation is a piece that I'm fascinated by. The youth mental health crisis really kicked into high gear in 2012, and a lot of well-intentioned interventions were put into place in order to address the needs of young people. And now there's a lot of researchers who are focused on evaluating the effectiveness of those interventions. And I think that evaluation is going to really guide what happens over these next 5 to 10 years. And I actually think that how well-being and particularly mental health is addressed, it's going to be one of the big differentiators between Gen Z and Gen Alpha. And so that's an area that I am closely following. And it's an election year. Yippee. It's my fourth election year in doing this work. So I do a lot in some of the predictions, theories, what can happen following some of that. And that's also a key area of my focus.
Okay. So I have a couple grab bag topics that I just was writing down as we were talking. I want to throw them your way. And I would say that these aren't necessarily generational, although they may have some generational elements. If anything, there might be an age thing, but they relate to work. And so I'm going to fire them off your way and you can either give me your take or what you know, and you certainly can pass as well because I didn't prepare you for this. But I'm just off a week of going to conferences where I talked about work the entire time. So these are things that are top of mind. So the first one, which I think hits on a couple things that you mentioned, but it is this idea of the employer-employee contract and the role of employers in the employer-employee contract, particularly in 2024. And I think it comes up in the sense of, you talked a little bit about how work is might be the last place where we can go to connect and work with people who are different from us, both in terms of working for an organization, as well as for that matter, just physically being somewhere where that happens. You also talked a little bit about just the morality and the role that employers have to take on and play in some kind of ways. Some might chalk this up to ESG, but just in general, in some cases, whether employers are doing this on their own or perhaps through the demands of their customers or their employees and who are asking them to take stances, it comes up there. Yeah, let's talk about this. Is this something you've looked at or seen, or is this something that you've thought about at all?
I do a lot of work with boards of directors. And so I remember back during the Me Too movement, the boards of directors for publicly traded companies were like, oh my God, what are we doing? Like, how are we supposed to navigate this? So I think that there's two questions there. I'll try to answer them as concisely as possible. In terms of this like role of morality, there is like an article and some research that comes out in HBR every single month about what should you make a public statement about, what shouldn't you? And I do think that it's definitely reached a point where we have enough case studies behind us to show that there simply is not a one size fits all. There are some CEOs who are being very outspoken, where they're really leading the conversation. They're not just waiting around for public opinion. And sometimes that works. Sometimes that works really well. There are some who try to create more of a culture of some neutrality and really focus on the people within their walls. How do we make sure that they feel supported, that they feel safe, that they feel respected? And that's where we'll, you know, and the rest will remain neutral. So, and both of those styles of leading have worked at various times and have failed at various times. And so it's really this introspective moment for leaders to figure out where you want to be in that. The one thing that I would definitely urge against is just following around public opinion, just following around what petitions are employees filling out, that kind of thing, because I think something that we have really learned is how fickle public opinion is. And just from a developmental standpoint, and I don't mean this in an infantilizing way at all, but the road from adolescence to adulthood is you change your mind and grow all the time. All the time you are learning and changing where you're at. And so I think if we put way too much on that, that this is where companies can find themselves in a really tricky situation. And then in terms of that employee relationship and the role of employers in that, there's always this question of people don't stay as long anymore. Young people, they're moving jobs all the time. And it's this question of, was it the chicken or the egg? Who broke this unwritten contract around loyalty? And the reality is that people do respond to the carrots that are put in front of them. And the data would show that the fastest way to make more money is to move jobs. And so that there's an economic reality to that. And you can't fault young people for responding to economic carrots. But I do still find that if people have a real road to mobility within their company, if they're working with good people in an environment where they feel appreciated and respected, it's obviously stickier, right? I'm not saying anything that you don't know that all of your listeners know. And so I would say the role of the employer in that is figuring out in an authentic way to your culture how what that looks like and how that is rolled out and in a more scalable way just across the organization.
There's some great thoughts, especially because I put you on the spot. Two follow-up thoughts to that. The first thing is that I think for many businesses, and in many industries, the fast follow or the copycat strategy from anything ranging to public statements to just general business strategy or launching products is something that they employ. One of my takeaways, I think, is that this specific issue is not one where you just want to copy what everyone else is doing. This is something that you collectively have to decide for your organization. And the best position I think that you can put yourself in if you are a company for this is to make sure that you are not being someone that you are not. And so the best thing that you can do is to commit to a set of actions or something and align yourself to, or you can commit to a set of words and aligning some actions that mirror those words. I think where a lot of companies get in trouble with this is when there is a difference between perception and reality. And the easiest way to not have that happen is to properly set expectations and manage to them. And so I think
absolutely. And I do want to say that you had a great you interviewed, I think Becky McCullough was her name.
Yes. Yes.
At HubSpot. And she talked to you about how they constantly revisit the HubSpot culture code to see if it is still right, if it still represents who they are, and they allow themselves that flexibility to iterate on it. And I thought that was just such a good takeaway that I want to credit her with and encourage people to really think about, is that we're not only are we allowed to iterate, we absolutely have to.
Yeah, that's such a great point. I do have another question that has come top of mind, and it stems from a conference I was just at. And it was on the notion of the employer-employee contract, but one of the chief people officers said, I know that you can work from home. I think you can have a job from home. I don't know if you can grow your career from home. And so there's that statement, which I'm still reflecting on myself, but my first reaction to that was, how are you defining a career? And on whose terms is defining what that career is? And so I'm just wondering if we can play with this for a second. Of one of my hypotheses has been around, just in today's day and age, the personalization of what a career means. And I think that for a long time, the idea, there was an alignment of your age, your life stage, and your career stage, where those directionally all were tightly knit. And I don't think that's really the case anymore for a multitude of different reasons. So I was reflecting, you know, on that idea when I heard that statement. And I don't know, I'm just following it up to you to see if you have any thoughts.
I really like how you stated that. And that is so true, that this like specific alignment on life stage, career stage, all of these things is, and there are the barrier to entry for entrepreneurship, solopreneurship, different streams of income, that barrier to entry is so low. And so if you are a ambitious person with some appetite for risk, your possibilities are so endless. And I think, Al, you probably are just an ambitious person who has some appetite for risk. And so it's might like come second nature to you. And then, but people's risk appetite is so personal. And so for as many opportunities as there are for really personalized career paths, there are always going to be huge swaths of the workforce, which is totally fine, that they do want something more structured, right? They do want something with a little bit more of that stability. And so I think there's a lot of options for personalization. And I still think that there is always going to be a massive part of the workforce that is uninterested in the personalized paths. So I think there's that one. In the topic of, can you grow from home? One of the studies that I found really interesting, it was a joint project through Harvard, University of Iowa, and the New York Federal Reserve, where essentially it's a working paper, but it's very compelling that older workers are more productive at home. And part of that does have to do with career stage, that they have social capital, they've got their reputation solidified, they have their connections, and they're in like an execution phase of their career where they know what to do and they know how to execute on that. And younger workers, it's just been very difficult to really mentor, to really identify high potentials and move them into a hypo track, more difficult to build these really organic relationships across generational lines. And so I think leaders are in a very difficult spot right now when we think about the back to office prospect, because in some ways they might have to sacrifice older worker productivity for younger worker growth. And that's tricky. And can people grow a career from home? People can do all kinds of things. But in a more traditional corporate environment, do I think that will be extremely difficult? Yeah.
Kim, these were great conversations. Thank you for indulging me on just the rapid fire. But as we wrap up here, there's always a couple of questions I love asking all of our guests. So Kim, as we close here, the first one of those questions is, what is one idea that you want leaders to think differently about so that they can create a better world of work for their people?
Don't try to replicate the 2019 world of work and leverage the technology that is available in order for parts of work to be more perfect, more useful, more effective, and then use those in-person, make those in-person moments more experiential, more immersive, more exciting. And I I think that combination can be so powerful, as if when people are together, they feel it. They're there for a reason. They are forming inside jokes. That culture is being built in a powerful way. And then the work that can be done better and faster with tech should be.
Kim Lear, thank you so much for coming on the Edge of Work podcast. If people want to find you or find your work, where should we point them towards?
Inlay Insights, and I write kids these days on Substack.
Hi, everyone. Al D here. Thank you so much for listening to the Edge of Work podcast. If you like what you heard, I encourage you to share the episode with a friend, as well as to head over to Apple Podcasts to leave a review and let us know what you think. I would be forever grateful if you did that. I would also love to hear directly from you about what episodes you're listening to or any suggestions you have for how we can make it better. You can find me on LinkedIn.